From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Playwright and author Pearl Clegg invites people to examine the messy, frequently irrational parts of human beings. In several best-selling novels, nonfiction books, and frequently performed plays, she dives into issues of race, sexual violence, family, and how we create identity in community. As a writer and educator, her fearless honesty and wit are infectious.
And I will never forget, I was teaching at Spelman, and the first day I gave my speech about find out what you're passionate about, and this will be where your work will come from, and all of that. And a young woman waited for me and came up to me after class and said, I loved what you said. What am I passionate about? And I said, I met you an hour ago. I have no idea. She had never thought about being passionate about anything. Mm-hmm. So she was delighted at the idea that she could be 18 years old and be passionate about something.
Pearl Clegg's newest play, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous, premieres at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta on March 20th and runs until April 14th. And we're going to talk to her about as much of her inspiring output as possible. Pearl Clegg, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, because you are good with sharing facts about yourself, we do know that you were born in Springfield, Massachusetts, and your dad, he was a civil rights activist. Bishop Albert Clegg Jr. was a minister, and eventually you moved to Detroit. How old were you when you moved?
Two. I was just two.
Oh, so you don't remember so much about Massachusetts.
I remember snow. That's exactly my entire memory of Massachusetts is snow.
That's pretty accurate for Western Mass. So why did you move?
My father was pretty radical, and his congregation in Springfield wasn't really ready for the things that he wanted to talk about, the kind of organizing in the community that he wanted to do. They were a lot more conservative than he was, and he was not a person who was known to compromise easily. Mm. So he left that church, and we went back to Detroit, which is where both my parents were actually from Detroit. So we went back there, and he started pastoring another church there.
So how did it go over there? He was preaching a gospel of black nationalism.
He was. And the first church that we had in Detroit, it didn't go over so well there either. And so he left that church and took 300 of the members with him. And they started another church. And for a while, we had Sunday services in a junior high school, Crossman Junior High School. I'll never forget it. And we were there for a while. And then we also had services and all. They bought a big house so that we lived in the house. But it also was the place where there was choir rehearsal and deacons meetings and youth group meetings, which was very exciting for me. I think it drove my mother crazy. But it was really wonderful. And then the congregation was able to raise enough money to buy a wonderful church building.
He really built a great reputation. He gained a lot of national attention, especially during the 1967 Detroit riots or rebellion, depending mm-hmm. on who you ask or who's telling the story. You were then 19. You were at Howard University at that time. So what was your vision of the country and the civil rights movement then?
Well, my vision of the civil rights movement was certainly influenced by the fact that I grew up in such an activist family, so that everything that we did revolved around a real feeling that your job at heart was supposed to be working toward the liberation of black people. So if you were going to be a nurse, that was fine, but you were also supposed to be working in the liberation struggle, a writer, a teacher, whatever you were doing, the heart of it was an engagement in the liberation struggle. So that I was raised in that, I loved it. I was always with my father, went to as many demonstrations as I could get to. When it was going to be dangerous, my mother often would not want me to go. So there was that kind of push and pull about how much do I want my own children to be involved in things that might be dangerous. Mm. But I took that with me to Howard University when I went there, and it was a wonderful time to be a student in Washington, not only because Howard had so many activist professors and activists who had gone there who came back, but also because as a student who wanted to protest things, you could just get on the bus and go right down to the White House and march around and scream at President Nixon and then go to the Washington Monument and scream at President Nixon. So there were ample opportunities for us to do that. But the riots were terrifying. People who romanticize riots have never been in one, because my father used to talk about this a lot. There is a difference between a riot and a rebellion. And we often want to romanticize it and say this was a rebellion. But it really was not an organized thing. It really was not something where people got together and planned what they were going to do. It was an outburst of emotion that came after years and years of police brutality, of discrimination, and all of that, so that it was terrifying to me. And I was in Washington when Martin Luther King was assassinated as a student, and they closed the campus because there was a riot in Washington. all around where we were. So we had to figure out a way to get to the airport. I got to the airport through that riot, got home to Detroit, and had to spend the night in the airport because there was also a riot in Detroit.
Yeah.
So that I went from one to the other, and it was absolutely terrifying and just so sad, you know, to see neighborhoods I had grown up in burn to the ground. And that was rage. You know, there was no organized plan of we're going to march somewhere and do something in an organized fashion. We were just going to show people how angry we were and how we weren't going to take it anymore. But it doesn't really build toward something else. It's that outburst. And then you end up with all of those ruined neighborhoods. And now how are we going to rebuild them? What are we going to do to replace what we took away?
So what did that make you think about expressing anger and how you wanted to do it?
Well, it made me think that expressing anger in that way was not helpful. And I had not been raised to think that was helpful. My father was about organizing. He was a separatist, but not in the sense of saying, we want five states. There were people who said, we want America to give us five states. And my father said, that's never going to happen. That's unrealistic. But for many, many black people in the United States, we were already separate. We lived on the west side of Detroit, completely black community. I went to school at Howard, in Washington, completely black neighborhood. I came to Atlanta. I live in Southwest Atlanta, almost completely black neighborhood. So that, you know, you look at where black people were at that time in Harlem, in Watts, already separate. And my father's idea was, well, then what we need to do is to accept the fact that we are living in these ghettos, in these separate communities, and make them wonderful. We need to make sure we have the best food in our grocery stores, that we have wonderful schools, and we can control that. So he was always about building institutions, strengthening institutions, and certainly understood the rage that would cause a riot and the absolute need to make that mean something that would encourage people to call it a rebellion. But he was about building things, about building institutions, so that you could influence people's lives over time.
And he knew Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he knew Malcolm X, ran in those civil rights circles, and both of those men were assassinated. Did this make you fear for his life?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified, because I knew he knew these people. He was certainly closer to Malcolm X, you know, in terms of what they believed about the world and what they believed politically. But I was always very frightened of what might happen to my father because there was so much violence. And I remember answering the phone once as a little girl and hearing someone on the other end of the phone telling me what they wanted me to tell my father about what they were going to do to my father. And I was standing in the room holding the phone, and my father came and took the phone and hung it up and said, don't answer the phone anymore because that's not for you to think about. Don't answer the phone. So I was very, you know, I adored my father, and I was very concerned that someone would harm him, but they never did.
He built a system of theology, social systems, as you're talking about, iconography, a huge man, a huge figure, not just for you, obviously, but for others. How about your mother? She was born Doris Graham. They did not stay together. Is that correct?
They divorced when I was six.
So what was she like, and what was her influence on
you?
Oh,
my mother was a wonderful, amazing woman. She was a teacher. She taught first grade in Detroit, then she taught junior high school in Detroit. She was a reading specialist, but she really wanted to be an archaeologist. She wanted to be somewhere in Egypt, looking at pyramids and looking at artifacts and all of that. And of course, that was not something where there was a path available to her as a little black girl growing up on the east side of Detroit. For her to take that seriously as a path, so that she became a teacher. I don't think she ever loved teaching. I've met many of her students over the years who said she was a great teacher who really loved her, but that was not what she'd wanted to be. So I think that there were things that she would have changed about her life, but that she was also very involved in the movement. She and my father divorced, but she continued to be an activist. She continued to be involved. She married again, and my stepfather was also a very activist person, so that the family continued to be very much involved in what was going on in Detroit and nationally.
We're learning about the life and origins of the prolific Atlanta playwright and author Pearl Clegg. Her newest play, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous, premieres at Alliance Theater in Atlanta on March 20th. All right, I'm going to shift forward a little bit here because you graduated from Spelman in 1971. You became the speechwriter for Maynard Jackson. Is that correct?
Well, I did several other jobs before that. When I first came to Atlanta, my very first job was working at the newly formed King Center. Martin Luther King had been assassinated only a year before, but Mrs. King, who was an activist in her own right, was already building the King Center. And I went there. That was my first job in Atlanta. I was one of the people who helped to collect materials from civil rights workers who had, you know, as many of us do who have done things that we think are important, we put everything in a box and put it in the basement, put it in the attic. And my job was to go to these people and say, let us have those boxes because we can keep those materials alive. We can make sure that people know what you did and know what happened because of what you did. So that I did that kind of collecting. And I also was transcribing. We had lots and lots of tapes that people had made of Dr. King. When he would come and speak, people would tape little tape recorders. And so we had a lot of those tapes, and I would spend hours transcribing the tapes, which was such an amazing job to spend 8 hours a day with Martin Luther King's voice in your head. It was, I can't even describe it, but it was really a wonderful kind of introduction to Atlanta. So I stayed there for maybe a year, a little more, and then I went to work at the Southern Education Program, which was a program that was dedicated to getting young Black graduate students who had just gotten their degrees to come and teach at historically Black colleges for 2 years. And then after that, I heard Maynard speaking. And I had gone, by that time, I had left the Southern Education Program. And I was working at ABC, the ABC affiliate here as a producer, as a television producer and writer. Didn't really like that job much, but I got to talk to a lot of interesting people. And Maynard came by one day, and I had already seen him. He was getting ready to launch his campaign, and I had seen him when I first got here running for vice mayor. And I remember looking at him thinking, oh my God, who is that? Because he was so much bigger than life. I mean, physically and in every way, charismatic, committed, passionate. And when he came by the studio to be interviewed on the program I was producing, I introduced myself and said, I would very much like to be involved in your campaign, which I'm sure my boss at the TV station would have hated that I was volunteering for a political campaign. But he said, well, great. You know, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm a writer. I would love to write speeches for you. So he asked me to write a speech. He was going to talk to a group of Vietnam veterans. And he asked me if I would write something. So my husband and I at the time wrote a speech for him, and we were sitting in our house. There's a window in the front, and we were sitting there, and a big black car pulled up out front, and out came Maynard Jackson, came to the door. I opened the door, and he said, that's the best speech anybody has ever written for me.
You're like, so, I know everything that Martin Luther King Jr. has ever written.
I had the rhythms. I had grown up on my dad. I had been listening to Dr. King. I was a playwright, so I was used to making people talk in their best cadences, so that when he said that, I was, you know, I was hooked. I worked in the campaign. I went to work at City Hall. I worked in the next campaign, and I wouldn't trade it. It was the hardest job I ever had working at City Hall, but I wouldn't trade it.
But a super heady time. You know, this is just, what, not even 10 years since the Voting Rights Act passed.
Exactly.
And he's mayor of Atlanta. Just amazing. But so you're writing for other people's voices. Is that something that you thought, I'm just going to do this?
Well, I had always written plays. I had written poetry, but I love theater. So I had always written plays. I mean, even as a little kid, like a fourth grader, I adapted, you know, a story, the story of Chicken Little about the sky falling. And my teacher said, oh, this is wonderful. You can tour this to the fifth and sixth grade. So I thought that was pretty wonderful.
That was your first tour.
My first tour. So I thought that was great. And I always had an admiration, and I think I get this from my father, from listening to my father. I always admired people who could take a very complicated idea and make it palatable, presentable, accessible to regular people who were going about their daily lives, who were just trying to keep their families fed, stay indoors, all of those things that you have to do as a human on the earth, but to take an idea that they might not necessarily have the opportunity to investigate as fully as you would hope they could. So take all of what you've learned and put it in a form where you can then pass it to someone and they can get it. And I watched my father do this. I remember my dad reading The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon. an incredible book, but a very complicated, dense work that you have to really think about and deal with. And I remember watching him read it, watching him thinking about it, and then hearing the sermon that emerged from his consideration of that work. And I was so in awe of his ability to do that, to make people not only understand the work, but to feel it, to understand why Fanon was so passionate, to understand what that means to take on the liberation of a whole group of people as your personal charge in your life. And I always wanted to be able to do that, to inspire people to find out what the truth is and go after it.
Well, we're going to find out a lot more of how you do that. Atlanta playwright and author Pearl Clegg is with me. We're going to be back with Pearl after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Atlanta playwright and author Pearl Clegg. Her new play is called Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous and opens at the Alliance Theater this month. We're exploring her body of work and her writing on race and gender and Black female identity, as in this 1995 play, Blues for an Alabama Sky.
You can't make it real just because you want it to be.
Are you really going to Paris?
Not the same thing.
Why isn't it? Oh, because you're some kind of genius with a dream and I'm just a colored woman out of a job.
Is that your dream? Singing for gangsters? And then what?
Well, then I'll have to figure out something else. Isn't that what you always tell me, one step at a time?
Okay, one step at a time.
Pearl, your 1993 collection of essays deals with the devil and other reasons to riot. This engages with a lot of issues that people don't generally like to talk about: domestic violence, sexism, racism. These are all through lines in your work, your plays, your novels, your newspaper columns. We didn't mention you were a newspaper columnist here for some time. Was this a conscious choice for you to go where other people generally didn't dare to?
I don't think about it that way. I think my conscious choice is always to give myself permission to write about the stuff that's driving me crazy. Because I figure if it's driving me crazy, it's driving some other people crazy too. So that I am always conscious of trying to be honest with myself about what I'm angry about, what I'm loving, what I'm not loving so much, about the communities where I live, about the people that I'm engaging with, all of those things. But I never think of what I write about as, oh, this is something that people don't usually talk about, because I'm prepared to talk about any and everything. And I think the key is finding a way to talk about it in a way that invites people in, rather than pointing that finger saying, you are so wrong about this. Let me tell you what the right idea is, because nobody wants to hear that. So what I'm always trying to do is to state the problem in a way that says to people, doesn't this drive you crazy too? Maybe we can think about it this way. Maybe we can work on it this way. But to first try to at least get consensus in the fact that this is a problem that we all think about.
So when I was reading through some of your earlier work, I was thinking, is Audre Lorde the quote, your silence will not protect you?
Right.
There's a way in that you're saying things that are challenging to people, but they may feel too afraid or clumsy or, if I say the wrong thing, I'll be judged in this kind of way. Did you ever feel that kind of judgment come back on you?
I never did. In fact, I have the opposite experience. Often when I write about the things that are the most difficult for me, that's when people will stop me in the grocery store, stop me in the post office, the two places where you get the most honest reactions from people. And they will say, that's exactly how I felt. I wish I could have written that. That sounds just like my family. That sounds just like my husband. That sounds like my neighborhood, whatever that is. So that I have found the opposite, where people will say, wow, you're so brave to have written about that. And it always kind of makes me smile, because it would be brave if people stopped me in the grocery store and said, you know, Pearl Clegg, you are really making me sick, and, you know, threw tomatoes at me or something. Mm-hmm. But they stop and hug me and want to talk a long time in the produce aisle about something that I've written. So that I think that many times we as writers self-censor because we're afraid of the response. And the response is often completely different than that fear that's making you think you shouldn't write about it, you shouldn't say it. Also, I grew up in a family, and certainly with my father, with someone who was prepared to say any and everything at the top of his lungs, wherever he was, fearlessly. So that in my family, you know, when people would come to me and say, wow, that was so radical, what you wrote. And I would say, you know, I'm the conservative in my family. You know, this is not wild and radical. You want to see wild and radical, you need to listen to my father. Because this that I'm doing is one step removed from what he was doing. Because I'm not trying to organize people in that same way, so that I have a lot more leeway to talk about things in a more gentle maybe way, because I'm not trying to consciously get people to do something specific, like go out and vote, like go down and protest in front of the police station. I'm usually trying to get them to think about something differently, to feel something differently, and then perhaps to make an individual change about that, so that I don't feel like I'm fearless in terms of talking about these things. I think I'm in a very strong family tradition. I think I'm in a very strong cultural tradition. African-American writers have a literary tradition where we're deeply rooted in and grounded in our communities, our struggles as a community, so that I felt like I was very much connected to not only the Black women feminist writers of my own generation, but, you know, to Langston Hughes and to Richard Wright and to all of those other writers who came before, who made it clear that the task is to tell the truth to the people.
Do you ever think that it was, however, felt like a kind of dual job for a woman who was a woman of color and also a woman? You know, that the gendered nature of your father was fearless about talking about what he wanted to talk about. Did it ever feel to you like those were conflicting to you, being a woman and being a Black woman writer?
Well, I think that my family was representative of many of the men of his generation, where they were prepared to talk about race, talk about racism, talk about all of those kinds of struggles endlessly. They were not as comfortable talking about sexism, because when you are a Black male talking about race, you're the victim. When you're a Black male talking to a Black woman about gender issues, you are often the oppressor. And that's a much different role. And that's not a very comfortable role. It's much more comfortable to be the one who is aggrieved, who says, these people are treating us badly. We have to do this. We have to do this. Rather than someone tapping you on the shoulder and saying, you know, you yourself as a man have some work to do about oppression in your own life and how that manifests in your relationships with the women that you know. And that was a very difficult kind of path, because there were not a lot of Black women feminists who were talking loudly in those settings. We would talk to each other, but there were not often those kinds of discussions where we talked about race and gender as if they were both important. And I remember myself when I would give speeches many years ago, and I would say, I have two forms of emergency in my life. I have race and I have gender. So I'm going to talk about race first, and then I'm going to talk about gender once I get race settled. Mm-hmm. And one day I heard myself say it, and I said, you know what? That doesn't make a bit of sense, because you can't be Black Monday, Wednesday, Friday, a woman, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and you get Sunday off. You can't do that. I'm Black and female every single day. Mm-hmm. So I get to talk about being Black and female every single day. And that was a big change in my own work, because then I no longer had to separate what I was looking at. I no longer had to say, there's this and there's that. It was only this, because it all comes together in me. And I think for me, particularly as a playwright, someone like, well, no one like, there's only one Intasake Shange ever was and ever will be. But that play made it clear that you could talk about race and gender in the most creative, artistic, passionate way. And it was all truth. And that was a moment, a turning moment for me as a playwright, to see that play and say, she's absolutely right. We get to put our truth, our stories on this stage in front of people, and then let them figure out how they feel about it. Our job is not to figure out what they're going to think when they receive it. Our job is to figure out what the truth is of this specific Black female experience and put it on the stage.
And that play being
For colored girls
who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. May she rest in peace.
Yes, indeed. She's a wonderful. She will always be someone who I think we revere, because she influenced so many of us in such a great way.
Well, we are doing some deep cuts today with Pearl Clegg. She's a best-selling novelist. She's a nonfiction writer and a beloved Atlanta playwright. Plays have been performed all over the world. And she's got a new one coming up at Alliance Theater this month. Well, I want to get to that, the when you're black and when you're female, because this is something that really came to a head. You wrote an essay in the 1990s, Mad at Miles, and it touched on the duality of Miles Davis as a beloved musician, but also a domestic violence perpetrator, and how fans wrestle with that. And you start off the piece by writing, I thought I wasn't going to be able to write this piece at all. I had been avoiding it for a month. So what do you remember about that process of getting to that point where you could write it?
Miles Davis was such a complicated individual, such a complicated human being. But I was not a big jazz fan. So that I asked a friend of mine who is a big jazz fan and was a jazz critic, said, okay, I'm trying to understand this music better. You know, can you help me? What can you give me that will help me understand it? So the first thing he said was, okay, you got to listen to some saxophone. So he gave me John Coltrane, which was lovely. But then I got to the next question about, okay, who else? And he said, well, you got to deal with Miles. So he made a tape for me of Kind of Blue, which is a classic, amazing Miles Davis album. And I was getting ready to take the train from Washington back to Atlanta. It's an overnight train. So he taped it for me, and I had my little Walkman on, and I'm sitting in the dark in the train watching America roll by and listening to Kind of Blue. And I fell in love with that music. It was just amazing to me. I couldn't believe it. So I played it over and over and over and over. And it's also such sensual music. And I was a single woman at the time. So it kind of became my seduction music of choice. So that I loved it because it was great music, and I loved it because it could set an atmosphere for
me. I think you're not alone in that.
That's right. Exactly. Then he wrote an autobiography, but he wrote it with Quincy Troupe.
Yeah.
And I read the book, and he was such a terrible guy to the women in his life. Cecily Tyson is the name we know, but so many of the women that loved him and wanted to nurture him and be with him were treated abominably by him and violently by him. And I remember reading it thinking to myself, this is terrible. How can someone who treats women in this way create such beautiful music? And what am I supposed to do with that? What am I supposed to do with the fact that I love this music? But he may have written it in the very day he was beating a woman to the ground. How can I justify listening to the music when I know who the person is? And that's where Mad at Miles came from. But I didn't want to write it. I actually wrote that as a performance piece for a series I used to do with my husband, Zarin Burnett, who's also a writer, called Live at Club Zebra. And I wanted to, as the performance progressed, break up the records, literally, on the stage, burn the tapes, burn the CDs, all of that. I wanted to do that. And I couldn't do it because I loved the music. And I couldn't bring myself to actually physically destroy the music. But it was such a difficult thing to even think about because he is such a major figure. And because I knew that he was going to bring forward in the people that loved him all kinds of responses that might not even let them get to the point of what I was saying. Mm. So that's why that piece, as a performance piece, it starts off, it's talking very seriously about what we're talking about. But then when you get to the end, it has some humor in it because I'm trying to give people a little release so that the men who came who were really angry at me for talking critically about Miles Davis would also be able to see, think about it this way. What if it wasn't a black man like Miles Davis beating black women? What if it was a white male artist who was beating black men? Would you all want us to continue to support that guy? Would you want to come over to our house and have us choose that guy who's beating you all up as our seduction music? And they would laugh because the very idea was just incredible to them. They couldn't understand it. But when they got to that, would you do it? They had to admit, no, of course they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And that gave them a space to just for a minute consider what it must be like to consider Miles Davis as a black woman.
Yeah, well, you were still accused of male bashing in some, you know, playing into white stereotypes about black men. But you wrote, the danger is that we have gone so long without asking the question that we have forgotten the answer. That this feels so relevant to look at that right now, especially given conversations about R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, new revelations, Bill Cosby. I mean, these are not new allegations, but they're revealed in this new era when that no longer, their celebrity no longer excuses them. So have we grown? I mean, how do you think about the failings of people that we elevate now that from 30 years ago when you wrote that?
I think we've grown. I think that the women's movement has done an incredible job of making us have a more elevated consciousness about what these oppressions look like, how they manifest in our real life. So I think that we've done a really good job with making people aware this behavior is not acceptable, making individual women feel empowered to say, I want this job, but this guy can't require this from me to keep this job. I think we've done a really good job with that. I think that we need another language to talk about these things in a way that acknowledges how complicated they are, because everything is not the same. One kind of harassment is not the same as another kind of harassment. A rape allegation is different than someone who makes an unpleasant work environment but never touches anybody. So that we have to figure out how to differentiate between these things and say, all of these behaviors are wrong, but they must be described. We have to say, what happened? What did Bill Cosby do? Is it a crime? If it's a crime, he should be charged. What did R. Kelly do? What did Michael Jackson do? And in those three specifically, those cases, it's so difficult because people love these men. They love their work. They love their music. They love what they've done. And they hate to believe that they were fooled all this time. It's like that old song by The Who about We Won't Be Fooled Again. Mm-hmm. It's that where in order to admit that Bill Cosby was not Dr. Huxtable, we have to admit that we were fooled all that time, that we didn't know what we knew, which is he wasn't really Dr. Huxtable. Somebody wrote that. He was really a grown man who was making choices that we choose to believe a person like Cliff Huxtable would never have made. We love R. Kelly's music. People have used that as seduction music forever. So we don't want to believe that he was a person who would abuse children. And Michael Jackson, beloved all over the world, people do not want to believe that he could also be a terrible pedophile. So that we have to come up on our worship of celebrity, our willingness to believe the story that the celebrity tells, and also the story that the person in power tells, even if they're not a celebrity, that we are more often likely to believe the boss than we are to believe the person who is charging the boss. And I think that's changing, which is really wonderful. And I think we're in a very messy transitional period now. You know, when people say things like, oh, this is a terrible time to be a man, you know, I want to say, please, give me a break. That is so not the issue. What we're talking about is trying to get men to understand that this isn't a question of men against women. This is a question of people who believe that certain behaviors are wrong, telling the people who don't yet understand why those behaviors are wrong or choose to ignore the fact that they know they're wrong, trying to get them to understand it. But it doesn't have to be all bad men on one side, all saintly women on the other side. We're all more complicated than that.
Well, I would love to get into that, the sort of messy, complex humans that come across in your plays. I'm speaking with Atlanta playwright and author Pearl Clegg. We're going to be right back after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Atlanta playwright and author Pearl Clegg. Her new play, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous, is opening at the Alliance Theater this month. Well, I watched a video. You were talking about your life in the theater and the place that it holds for you. You know, you keep coming back to it, including this new play. Do you feel the tug differently from theater than the other writing that you do?
Oh, I do. Theater is completely different because the other forms of writing that I do, I don't write much poetry anymore. Sometimes I do. But poetry or essays or novels, you write that by yourself alone. And then people experience it alone. So that it always is a very solitary process. And even playwriting, when you're working on the play itself, the script, it's a very solitary activity, writing is. You have to eventually stop talking to your friends about how wonderful the play is going to be or the wonderful the novel is going to be and go sit somewhere by yourself and write it, which is a lot less fun than drinking wine with your friends talking about it. But it's a solitary activity. But theater, once it's written, you're in rehearsal and you're with a whole tribe of people. You've got actors, designers, directors, producers, rarely, but you have lots of people that you're working with to bring that thing to life, to make these people actually walk around and talk and sing and do what they do. And there isn't any other form that I work in that does that. I don't get to know how people feel about what I've written in a novel unless they stop to tell me.
At the grocery store.
At the grocery store, that's right, which is always wonderful. But in a play, you get to know immediately because if the joke works, people laugh. If the joke doesn't work, there's dead silence, and you know that too. But it's an exchange between you and the people that you wrote it for that only occurs in theater, and I don't think any of the other forms have a way to do that. You can read from your novel. You can read your poem. But if you can create characters that move around and make a story come alive for people where they've agreed to come together and sit there and listen to a story, there isn't anything else like that.
Well, there are some characters that you've stuck with. Blue Hamilton in your books, definitely. And Jenny Anderson. She appeared at age 30 in your play Hospice. And last year in the follow-up, Pointing at the Moon, where she's 60, and then reflecting on her life. So what is your attachment to these characters? What grabs you about them that you want to stay with?
Well, there's some characters that just don't leave my brain after I work with them. They have more stories that they want me to tell. They have more adventures that I keep thinking about so that they come back around. Blue Hamilton, who appears in many of the novels, is such a rich, interesting character, and I always have to thank my husband for that because there's so
Wait,
many—
Wait, is he the inspiration for Blue?
He's totally the inspiration for Blue.
I bet everybody wants to.
Totally the inspiration for Blue. And it's so many of the things, I mean, literally some of the things that Blue says are things where I would, because my husband is a writer too, I would ask him, can I use this? You know, because it's so perfectly what I want this male character to say. And he very generously will always give me permission. But he is an interesting character. And I think people find him so appealing because he is someone who is working on gender questions and race questions and community questions and all of those things in a highly unconventional way because he's a gangster. If somebody does really bad things and the law doesn't take care of it, he takes care of it. And my job when I write a character like Blue is to make sure those people that he's taking care of outside of the law are so horrible, so awful, have done something so terrible that the reader will go with me when I step outside of the law and say, this needs to be taken care of. And you have to be very careful with that because I don't want to encourage people to think they should just go around killing people, you know, if they think they're doing wrong. So that I even had to create a story where he had someone who was working with him who kind of stepped around the regulations for how you do this. And he had to be chastised severely for that. So that it's even in the creation of fictional characters, I want to be sure that what I'm putting forward are things that I want people to understand and if not admire, at least know that this is something justified by the circumstances of that character. And Jenny was just a very interesting character to me because I kind of was thinking about her and what might have happened to her in those 30 years since we last saw her. And then a play kind of came to me where she could be 60 years old in that play and I could look at her 30 years later and see how she had evolved, how she had changed. But I don't often do that. I usually try to make new characters for new stories. But if they come back around and knock on the door hard enough, I let them in.
Well, I think a lot of people want to see more Blue, certainly.
I know they do.
I know they do. But, you know, okay, so you talked about, you know, his... He's not a perfect human, and that, and something that we were talking about just before the break, that we have to be responsible for our own decisions. And there's something you said in that talk, it was like, human beings can be counted on to do the wrong thing as much as they do the right. So that's a very compassionate view, that you know this about other human beings, but you're not judging them. Is that part of your approach? You know, you talked about earlier about we have to get into the space where we can actually engage with each other.
It is. It's very important to me to be able to look at a range of human behaviors and not judge them. And that's very hard to do because we do bad things as human beings. And it's easy to kind of forgive people for small things. It's hard to forgive people for really terrible crimes against children, for example. So that you really have to be able to train yourself as a writer to listen to what these characters would say to justify their own behavior. Because I'm creating these people, I'm making them up, so that I have to understand them deeply so that I can pick the part of them that belongs in that story. So that I have to be able to look at a full range and say, this one is doing this because of this. This one is doing this because of this. This one I can forgive and hope they can move forward. This one has to be eliminated and taken out of the story, taken out of the love affair, taken out of the community because they can't be redeemed. But it has to be something that comes forward because of their behavior, not me going in saying, this is a bad guy, let me just make him a villain. Because nobody cares about that, you know, that snidely whiplash kind of twirling the mustache villain. That's too easy. And villains don't announce themselves like that. If they all came with, like, the music in a movie where you know it's a bad guy because his music is so threatening, or you know it's a bad guy because he's got that mustache that he's twirling, it would be great if life was like that, because then when you see a guy twirling a mustache, you know to run. Exactly. You know when he opens the door and that music is playing, time to go. But that's not how it happens. You know, oftentimes the people who do bad things are as seductive, if not more so, than the people who do good things, so that you have to understand why. And there's a Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a wonderful Buddhist teacher, talks about thinking about people when they were 3 years old, before they became whatever the problematic thing is that you meet them and they're carrying it. That if you can think about them when they were 2 years old, 3 years old, a baby, before they had all the experiences that made them do these terrible things, that it's easier sometimes to feel compassion for that baby, and then you can try to make yourself move forward and understand that nobody becomes a bad human being by choice. Something happened that made them think that was a good choice. And people will, of course, argue that with me. Some people are born bad. Some people are, I don't believe that. I believe that people are born into circumstances that are often extremely difficult and problematic, or circumstances that look fabulous from the outside, but from the inside are very difficult. And they grow up in that and with that. So when we meet them, they're carrying all of that we don't know. And as a writer, I have to figure out what that is so I can make the person not a cardboard villain, but a real flawed human.
Pearl Clegg is with us. She has a new play that is premiering at the Alliance Theater, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous. And I want to hear a little bit about that play, but especially framing it in what you just said, that, you know, it's not villainy and goodness and villainy necessarily, but the degrees, the many degrees and many variations inside of that. And this is a play that deals with these intersections, history, legacy, women's roles in society. I think vanity comes across a lot here, you know, fear of, you know, what's going to happen to me? What is my legacy? Can you give us a little bit first of a summary of the play?
It has four characters, four women characters, and they are representative of different generations. Two of them are 65 years old, one of them is 45 years old, and the baby is 25 years old. And they come together on the eve of a women's festival, and the festival is called Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous, a festival of women's voices. And two of them have been living in Amsterdam for almost 30 years.
Kind of in retreat.
Mm-hmm, exactly, because the one did a very scandalous Willis piece at the National Black Theater Festival many years ago, where she was providing a feminist critique of the plays of August Wilson. And people did not take to it, so that they put her on a list of problems, so that she couldn't get hired, she couldn't get a job, she couldn't do the work she had been trying to do. So she left to do some work in Amsterdam, and then ended up staying for a long time. But now she is at an age where she's beginning to have to look at, am I still going to be able to do this work? I can't remember all the lines to Medea like I used to. I can't remember Agamemnon's whole script like I used to. So what am I going to do now that I see this as something that's real in my life? And the fear that comes with that, the fear that comes with, now I'm not going to be able to do what I love. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have this, who am I? So she's dealing with all of those questions, and then she meets the 25-year-old who is going to do the role that made her famous. And she has a very, very difficult time understanding the whole idea. People say pass the torch, and it sounds like such a graceful, wonderful thing, but it's often someone wrestling that torch away from somebody. And she's at that moment where she has to really look at, what does it mean to communicate with someone who is so much younger, who needs to know and wants to know what you know, but also represents a threat professionally, but on a greater scale represents mortality. You're not 25 anymore. You can't be 25 anymore. And what does that mean, especially in a youth-obsessed culture like this one? What does that mean for a woman who made her living allowing people to look at her, being beautiful, being fabulous, being a diva, and now she's an older person, and people are not offering her the lead roles anymore. They're offering her the sub-roles, and she just can't stand it. It just makes her angry, and it frightens her. And fear, I think, is always the thing that makes people make their worst decisions. When you're afraid, you make the worst decisions of your life. And so she's in the process, when we meet her, Anna, of making a whole lot of bad decisions because she's afraid, and being pushed by the younger generation to let them in.
Well, you are a woman who's been an educator for a long time. Do you still teach at Spelman? I'm not sure.
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
You taught at Spelman for many years. Tayari Jones, one of your famous
acolytes. One of my famous students, that's right.
and still continue to work with teens in the Alliance Theater Program. So I'm wondering for you, you know, how at this stage in your life, a long career behind you, still producing, still doing great stuff, and always the younger person coming up to, you know, be the next big shiny thing that people land on. Were you working something out for yourself here in this play?
I'm always working something out for myself, and I often don't even realize what it is until I see these wonderful actors that I'm working with performing the piece in front of me, and then I say, oh my goodness, that's what that's about. I thought it was about this, but it's really about that. And even for this play, I was thinking about it in terms of conversation between generations, and thinking about, you know, hardworking Nancy Pelosi trying to talk to all those young freshmen who are coming in, who are pushing her to do more and to do differently and all of that. So I was thinking that it was really more about that. And we did a run through the other day, and I was listening to the two older women characters talking. And I thought to myself, this is a play about aging. I had no idea. It's certainly about communication between generations, but it's also about a part of that communication being looking at the fact that you're not 25. And what does that mean? And I don't have the same challenge that performers have, because I'm a writer. You know, I can be a little old lady who can't hardly walk around, but as long as I can hold a pen, I'm good. But if I'm a singer in a youth-obsessed pop industry, if I'm an actor, if I'm a television star, then I have to worry about, are there lines on my face? You know, do I have the same kind of sex appeal that I used to have? So I don't have to deal with that. I don't even have to deal with memorization, because I write it, I give it to them. They have to memorize what it is. But I do have to deal with, what does it mean to be an older woman in a culture that often makes us feel invisible? Because so much of what we believe about ourselves as women comes from how we see ourselves reflected back from the often male-dominated culture. So we're looking at ourselves through an eye that is not us. So we believe that we have to look a certain way. We believe that we have to be appealing to a certain number of people, so that we end up with someone like Cher, for example, who was a beautiful woman who has had so much plastic surgery on her face that her face can no longer move to show you how she's feeling. And I watched her at the Kennedy Center Honors when Adam Lambert was reforming her song about Do You Believe in Life mm-hmm. After Love, which is a great disco song. And he made it a ballad that was just heartbreaking. And they put the camera on her and you could see her face struggling to show emotion, and it was absolutely impossible. That face was no longer a human face capable of emotion. And I felt so protective of her and so deprived of what it would have been like to see Cher's actual, real face as a 72-year-old beautiful woman. Mm. Because she was beautiful at 20. She was beautiful at 30. She would have been beautiful at 72 as a beautiful older woman. But we'll never know. So many of the women that we see are changing their faces, trying to be younger, so that we don't get to watch a woman aging gracefully. We don't get to say, this woman is beautiful now, she was beautiful then, in a different way, so that we're running to try to be 25, 35, 40, and we can't do it. And the play kind of looks at Anna having to come to terms with that, to say, well, I'm not what I used to be, but maybe I'm something equally interesting. Maybe I'm something equally appealing. Maybe I'm something equally lovable, even though I'm no longer 25 and dewy and fresh and all of that, where I'm older and experienced and have seen more and felt more and done more. And I think that that's the space I want to see older women able to step into and to be able to laugh about it. You know, that's what my husband and I laugh a lot. You know, we used to be able to do this. Now we can't do that. We used to be able to do this. You know, I used to be a dancer. I could sit on the floor cross-legged for hours, jump up and run around. Now, if I got down on the floor cross-legged, somebody would have to come and pick me up off the floor. Hey, help me get to where I'm going. But it's kind of amusing when you can put it out there, because it helps you dissipate the fear to say, wow, I used to love to do that. Now I can't do that. What can I do that I still love? Let me do that and see how that can fill that space in a way that is pleasing to me.
Are you going to be doing this forever, the thing you love?
Absolutely. I totally am. You know, people keep saying, oh, they're developing programs where you can just talk and then it will type it out. But that's not the same, because I use words differently when I'm writing than I do when I'm talking. So I'm intending to still be able to clutch that pen and still do it forever. And I look at a woman like Georgia O'Keeffe. You know, when I look at the pictures of her when she was so old with the long black cloaks and she's got a little cane and she's walking around in the hills in New Mexico, and I think to myself, that's a role model. You know, because she was still beautiful. She was still vibrant. She was still creative. And I want that to be something that young women see. I want them to see us get older. You know, we taught them so much as wild, feminist, radical, passionate, sexual women. We taught them a lot. And now we can teach them a lot about how to be older women who have all of those same wonderful characteristics, but who are 70 rather than 30. And I think that if they can be open to it, and we can be open to how they manifest those things that we gave them, those gifts we gave them, it'll be wonderful, because we'll learn something on each side of that.
Pearl Clegg, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pearl Clegg, the Atlanta playwright and author. Her new play, Angry Raucous and Shamelessly Gorgeous, premieres at Alliance Theater in Atlanta on March 20th and runs through April 14th. There's more information about the play at our website, gpbnews.org. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.